Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's edition of the show is brought to you by Microsoft. Thanks, guys. And it's a special edition. I'm basically on holidays and traveling for work for the next 3 weeks, so there will be no news section for a little bit. But don't worry, we'll be back to regular programming in 3 weeks. But until then, we've got some killer feature interviews for you. This week, you'll hear from InQtel CSO Dan Gear and McAfee CTO George Kurtz. Then next week, we've got a blockbuster half-hour interview with Risky Business favourite Brian Snow. That's a cracker. And the week after, you'll be hearing from Australian security researcher turned PhD student Silvio Cesare, who'll be telling us all about his research project into control flow signature-based malware detection. So it's a jam-packed few weeks with a lot of quality stuff. But back to this week's show now, and we're tackling a pet interest of mine. It's always struck me as odd that when a credit card transaction turns out to be fraudulent, it's the merchant who foots the bill. It seems weird because the merchant isn't really in a position to implement the required changes to our transaction and authorization systems that would actually cut fraud or make fraud more difficult. Now, if you cut fraud, you cut the bad guys' budgets. If you cut the bad guys' budgets, you cripple their ability to innovate, research ODAs, and create malware. So we've got this weird situation now where the payment card industry data security standard has sort of been lumped onto the merchants, and it costs them a fortune to comply. It doesn't really do much. That compliance itself is of questionable benefit. I don't really think compliance makes you that much less likely to be breached. That's just my guess from what I've read and researched. Now, I'd hazard a guess that if you added up all the money being spent on PCI DSS globally, it would be a pretty staggering figure. I think it would probably be cheaper, almost certainly be cheaper, to abandon the credit card payment model and come up with something fairly secure from scratch. And that way we wouldn't have to pay consultants $120,000 a year to find cross-site scripting bugs in merchant websites. The problem is the banks aren't motivated to do that because they're not hurting. The merchants are hurting. So I've often wondered why governments don't draft some legislation that would shift at least some of the liability for credit card fraud back onto the banks and card issuers. That way, it might just hurt them enough so that they start thinking of more intelligent ways for people to do business online. You know, smarter than just providing consumers with little plastic cards with numbers printed on them. It's 2010, for heaven's sake, you know? Anyway, I had a chance to interview George Kurtz, the CTO of McAfee, and Dan Gear, CSO of InQtel, about this pet peeve of mine. First off, we're going to hear from Kurtz, who I sat down with in Sydney a couple of months ago. Here he is.
I think looking at the liability model, I think it's probably due for an update in 2011. But what I was going to say, though, it is actually a complex problem when you think about trying to solve all this, particularly across geographies. I mean, one of the big issues that you have, certainly in the U.S., is chip and PIN is non-existent. I mean, just we're like the worst offenders.
It's the same here, pretty much.
Of MaxRite. Well, you guys at least, have you're getting there. I mean, compared to Europe, we're a disaster. We're, the hucksters have just moved to card not present as opposed to MaxRite issues. But then you have, just the ecosystem. You have small merchants that have very low margins that can barely get by. And then, how do we ask them to begin to swap out all of their point of sale systems? It's not as easy as just shifting the liability. I think it's a very multidimensional problem and complex.
Just an idea, right? How about we say that they're responsible for 5% of the fraud on transactions that they've okayed? And then we ramp it up by, say, 2.5% every year. How quickly do you reckon they'd solve the problem?
When fraud becomes painful enough for them to deal with it, it'll be solved. And right now, which is really the problem, it's become painful, but the pain has been distributed back out to the merchants, right?
That's kind of what I'm getting at.
That's exactly right. So if you can concentrate the pain, or you can actually collectively rise the tide of all pain across all of the folks in the ecosystem, then you'll actually have some change.
The thing that really annoys me about all of this, right, is that banks and card issuers look at the effect that it has on their bottom line, and they can lose X amount to fraud, right? And they look at the cost to them. But would you agree that there's a wider cost, a bigger cost inflicted on society when money winds up in the hands of criminals?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at what the criminals are doing, if you look at just the human element, I like to take the human element. I can give you facts and figures of malware and fraud and everything like that. But if you look at the human element about how much it actually impacts people, I think that's an area that really goes unfocused on. We actually did some pieces at McAfee, which was H-Commerce. It's on YouTube, where we actually profiled people who had tremendous amount of fraud in their own lives, and they've been decimated, right? So when you actually push it down to the people who were impacted, yeah, maybe they were made whole, but think about the mess that they actually have to go through to try to get it cleaned up. I mean, if you have one financial institution, it's a disaster. If you have five and six and you have government agencies, you know, you have people that are ready to throw themselves in front of a bus, literally. I mean, I've talked to people, some of the cybercrime folks in Australia where folks have been bilked out of, you know, millions of dollars of money, and the guy literally wanted to throw himself in front of a bus. So the human element, I think, is really important, as opposed to just, you know, how do we deal with the fraud aspect? And it goes well beyond just the dollars and cents.
On this liability thing, though, why is it that, do you think, that governments haven't quite cottoned onto this yet? Because they're the only ones who can actually... I believe that PCI DSS is actually a market failure, pure and simple, and that it's one that can be quite easily corrected with a little bit of influence from governments. Why aren't they onto this? Are they onto this and they just don't want to piss off the banks? I mean, what's the go?
There's only one word. It's called lobbyist.
You think that this is something that is actively being lobbied against, but that would suggest that there are people who actually are floating this as a legislative change to begin with, but I don't even think that's happening.
Well, you know, it depends on where you are, certainly in the world. It depends on who you're dealing with. I think in general, government... they've got a lot to deal with, and some of these technology issues are very perplexing to them. You know, most cases they can barely recreate a financial bill that would, you know, help the structural integrity of our financial system across the world. So then when you move down to, you know, PC card, PCI and payment card security, you know, their eyes glaze over. So
well, then, you know, the House of Reps in the U.S. had that big committee last year, I'm sure you remember it, into PCI DSS, and they nailed it. I mean, they had the recordings up. I listened to the hearings. They basically came out and said, yeah, PCI's not working. It's a disaster. It's inflicting costs on merchants that are being passed on to consumers. They basically determined that it was a massive drag on the economy. And then, just like Kaiser Soze, it disappeared into thin air.
The power of lobbying.
So you really think there are people actively lobbying against legislative change that would put more liability onto financial institutions?
Certainly. I mean, you have two competing factors. You have consumers, you have business, and there's going to be folks that take different sides of the aisle, and, you know, they're going to push their agenda forward.
Personally, would you like to see the liability start to go the other way?
I'd like to see shared liability. And, you know, I take a very pragmatic approach. If people manage money like it was their own, their behaviors changed. And if you can provide an incentive model where a lot of this back-end authorization takes place, and again, you know, things happen and ultimately the merchant's held liable, some guy in a gas station is just throwing his arms up going, you know, what do you mean? I mean, he's just trying to process the credit card. And I think if you can create the right incentives, then I think you actually solve this problem, which is similar to cybercrime. We talked at this focus conference about why malware is on an exponential rise, and there's just too much money too readily available with little impact of actually getting caught, which allows the bad guys to operate with impunity. And until we actually deal with the root cause of the issue, which is it's too easy to make money, we're going to see malware just recreate itself in various forms from, you know, here on.
It is really ridiculous, isn't it, to think that banks would start treating the money that they are custodians of as if it were their own. That would solve a lot of problems, though.
I have no comment on that.
George Kurtz, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much. Pleasure.
George Kurtz speaking to me in Sydney. Now, Dan Gear is an industry legend who's kind enough to join us on Risky Business every now and then. He currently serves as the Chief Security Officer of InQtel. And offline, Dan and I have previously discussed the skills shortage in the information security industry. It's my view that all this work we're doing to try to secure merchant websites and systems is actually drawing skilled security people away from where they're really needed. It's my view that the skills shortage is related directly to the issue of liability and credit card fraud. So I got Dan on the line to discuss the theory with him and see if we could speculate about how the skills shortage might play out in the future.
Nobody wants to accept liability. Mm. I mean, let's be clear. One thing that happened, at least in the States in 1968, was to assign the risk, which is exactly what you're describing. It's not so much of, exhorting everybody to solve the risk or providing a solution for everybody that makes the risk go away or whatever. You just assign it. And with the credit cards, that was the $50 limit, the idea that there is a loss limit that if you report the card stolen or misplaced or whatever, you're only liable for a small amount of money before the liability all goes back to the card association and the card issuer, ultimately. Mm. And that business was of assigning risk. I mean, to a degree, that is what you're asking. And, yeah, sure, every lobbyist and his brother would get involved there. But I guess the right answer is if you can't figure out how to solve the risk, assign it.
Mm. Well, and this is the thing, is at the moment, the people who are being asked to mitigate the risks are the people who aren't really in the best position to do that. The people in the best position to do that are the banks and the card issuers and the people who run those transaction systems and who have control and can say, look, we're going to do transactions a different way from now on. But instead, we're having merchants being instructed to essentially waste huge amounts of money on complying with all sorts of standards. And at the end of the day, it's the consumer that pays for that.
That's, of course, true. Mm. I'll say that I worked for a company called Open Market. We were just one of many companies involved in trying to make transactions possible on the Internet.
Mm.
Every payment company that I was aware of, everyone that was trying to make a payment system, and these are all now companies that are not here anymore, CyberCash is an example, First Virtual is an example, so forth. Every one of us did something that actually improved security in the following way, which was at the end of the transaction, the merchant did not know how you paid, but did know what you bought. The bank did not know what you bought, but did know who to send the money to. In other words, separating out the whole of the transaction so that no party had it all except the customer. All of us did that. Our payment protocols, all of us did that. All the companies did that. We did it. Everybody else did it. And this was a security advance. It was a good thing. And yet, the merchants killed it. Why? Because the merchants wanted to make it easy to do refunds.
Mm.
If you're going to do refunds, you can't have that, what I just described. And every one of us was forced by our customers to put back into the transaction the information of what bank would I send the refund to, meaning give me the credit card number, or conversely to the credit card company what it was we bought so that later you could erase that single transaction. And the pressure there from the merchants defeated an admirable security advance. That's because what they wanted us to do, and it's natural, is automate what they already did.
Mm.
And what you're suggesting, and I think it's a good suggestion, is if we just keep automating things that don't work, all that happens is that they don't work and they work, and that happens quicker.
Yeah, they don't work on a bigger scale.
Yes, much more efficiently.
Yes, that's right. I think that it's the fact that we are doing things on such a massively inefficient scale. That's why we've got guys who are 2 years out of university earning astronomical amounts of money to do fairly basic stuff when it comes to stuff like web application auditing.
Well, a little of that too is credentialism, in the sense that those people who are my age in security didn't get any training because there wasn't any.
Mm.
Whereas we are slowly being replaced, and it's only natural, but we're slowly being replaced by people who actually do have training. And so the idea that you take someone who has learned everything from the School of Hard Knocks and you replace them with someone who has a degree, well,
it is what it is.
It is what it is,
No. I mean, I grew up. I can't claim to have any technical skill myself, but I grew up. I went to a high school where there were a lot of hackers. I grew up watching these guys doing some pretty cool stuff. And, it's been interesting to me over the last 10 years to watch people come into the industry who didn't have that background. I mean, even guys who have become extremely successful, like David Litchfield. He ran NGS software. He sold that business, it was a family business. They sold it for something like £11 million
right.
last year. Dave is a very well-known database hacker. And, he originally studied zoology, I think, at university.
Sure.
And then just kind of decided to get into
sure.
security.
But I know in this country, and I suspect in yours, the pressure at the federal level to start requiring companies, in addition to everything else you were just describing, to require them to hire people who have certification.
I don't know that that's necessarily the case here, Dan, to be honest. I mean, it's
well,
I know that there's
good.
A big push. I know that there's a big push in the United States at the moment to have anyone who touches a government computer to be sort of registered in some way. But it's not something that we've faced here yet.
And maybe this is just us, but we are amazingly subject to the argument that if things didn't go right, it was because they didn't have sufficient credentials. We're at, if you want to call it that, at some risk of having it not just be thought of as a good, maybe good practice or something, but becoming a formal requirement in the compliance sense.
Mm.
And that won't help. And yet at the same time, it will do just what you started this conversation with. It will raise the price, if you will, for people of limited skill will get paid even better.
Mm.
Because you have to hire them.
We've discussed this previously offline, which is why I wanted to do this interview. You seem to be of the firm belief that the pipeline that is currently full of people coming into the industry, right? There's a pipeline. It is not wide enough. It is not producing enough talent to keep wage pressure down, to produce enough skilled people to do what we need them to do in the industry.
Is that what you believe?
Yeah.
But by pipeline, I mean the formal pipeline, as opposed to people who just, as one would say, hang out their shingle.
Hmm.
And I do fear that the ones who just hang out the shingle, there's a rising, if I may call it that, charlatan fraction of the industry, people who, and of course, the fact that there is a rising charlatan fraction is where the demands for certification come from.
Mm. It's kind of a worry when the people hiring these people don't even have the skills themselves to assess the skills of the people they're hiring. I guess that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, that's correct. Mm. That's correct.
How do you believe that we can dig ourselves out of this hole, this sort of skills hole that we're in? What do you think needs to happen?
Oh, God, I wish I had a good answer to that. In a way, just as you were saying, the fact that we have a problem which is insolvable doesn't mean you can solve it by throwing more people at it. It would be a good bit more productive to make it such that we didn't have to have a solution to there are not enough people.
Yes.
And therefore, we should make more of them.
Yes.
And that would be clearly the best answer.
Mm.
It's quite possible that, you know, every large company, for example, has awareness programs. I don't know how well they work. And in fact, I think they're something that are necessary but insufficient. Can we make enough people aware that we don't need as many experts? I don't think so. Can we somehow say that just as in the past there have been episodes where we put a great deal of effort in this country, and I'm sure others have done similar things, and we got to have more nurses, or we got to have more scientists, or we got to have more people who have math and engineering backgrounds, and we're going to do lots of things that increase the, if you will, the size of the pipe. That's certainly something that's within any government's capabilities, and those capabilities are ones that might well be thought to be critical. And if, as we get more and more dependent on these electronic, digital, whatever you want to call it, technologies, perhaps it does become a matter of national priority. That just as if you say, I want to have a country that is got a strong engineering science and innovation a component, we have to put real money into training more people who have those skills. It's quite possible that increasing the size of the pipe is an important function of government. But, of course, that has a 10-year, a 10-year horizon. It takes a while to teach enough teachers to make the pipe bigger. It takes a while to build enough facilities to make the pipe bigger, et cetera. In the short run, I don't think that necessarily works.
What about automation? Because we're seeing increasingly, code scanners and things like that are becoming increasingly popular. They're being acquired by big companies.
Well, yeah, automation. At some point, we say we'll never have enough people. Maybe it isn't that we don't have enough people. It's maybe that people are not fast enough. I mean, if Moore's Law becomes at some point our enemy, like, I know I'm not getting twice as smart every 18 months, I'm not getting twice as fast every 18 months, et cetera, maybe we do have to have more automation, and that maybe at some point we do have to turn protection over to machines. And, oh, I do hope if we do that, we got it right.
Otherwise, you wind up with Terminator 2.
Or The Matrix or something, right. exactly. If you're going to do that, make sure you get it right. Because it's unlikely that if you really build sentient protectors, it's unlikely that they'll think it's funny if you try to turn them off.
Well, you know, I don't know, even know if it's about them being sentient, but it's sort of like I'd almost call this the Airbus solution.
Yeah.
You know, it's that degree of fly-by-wire, you know, you've kind of got a pilot there. The joke about Airbus is that, you know, in any one of them, you've got a pilot and a monkey. The pilot, you know, goes in and turns the plane on, and there's, a monkey with a stick whose job it is to hit the pilot if he tries to touch anything.
Exactly right. And that may well be the answer. I mean, it is frequently a topic of conversation. And, for example, early management courses where you say, you know, you sort of review the history of the telephone in the United States. And at one point, and this included my relatives, there were a lot of people, and especially women, who were telephone operators. And as telephone usage grew, it became apparent that it wasn't possible to deploy enough operators.
Mm.
And so we automated that. Maybe you're right on the money. Maybe what you're saying is that if you declare a people emergency, your response should be eliminating the need for people.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting at with the whole idea of creating, you know, more secure transactions is one way of doing that. If you've got some thought that's gone into creating a secure process, you know, and the one thing is, right, I was asked to be on to do a radio interview the other day, right, about internet scams. And they asked me, you know, what can people do? What are some of the popular scams out there? And I said, look, there's no point talking about which scam, you know, what you shouldn't do. You know, I said, basically, there's no way you can really provide a succinct explanation or a succinct set of instructions that'll stop people from getting fleeced. Because at the moment, there's 17,000 things that we tell people not to do. They tune out after we've told them 10 of those things. If we can manage to create a way of doing business where instead of the 17,000 things people shouldn't do, there's perhaps 3 or 4 things that they should do, all of a sudden, about 80% of our problems go out the window.
Well, we're sort of headed that way in a sense of the smartphones are on private networks that are not the public internet, and the smartphone is not a general-purpose computer except in the extent that it is, from the point of view of the provider, it is. But from your point of view, you don't get to do anything you just want with it. It is much more, if you will, controlled than having a laptop connected to the internet is controlled. And in a way, we're sort of headed in that direction for those because the smartphones are, in fact, fast eclipsing the laptop as the mode of use. And I should point out that in the world at large, and I don't mean in a rich country like the United States, but in the world at large, the modern world and the smartphone are one and the same.
Mm. Well, now, I mean, you know, you look at the stuff that's happening in Africa with dumb phones. You look at the way that people are conducting commerce via SMS messages. People are actually transferring money via SMS. It's
right.
This incredible peer-to-peer ground-up banking system that, you know, the economic benefits to Africa of mobile telephony are incredible. There's people who, instead of having to travel for 3 days on buses, you know, to tell their family they got engaged, can now make a phone call. You know, stuff as simple as
that. Right, exactly right, exactly right.
Dan, how urgently do you think things need to change? Because as much as we whinge and sook about it, you know, the sky is not, in fact, falling in. There is fraud out there. There is graft. But, you know, we can't really say that it's inflicting an unacceptable level of harm on the community. Do you think this is something that will change, or do you think we're just going to have to grin and bear it?
Grin and bear it. You know, I'm gonna quote Marcus Ranham here.
Okay.
He's always good for a soundbite, and more. Don't get me wrong. I'm not denigrating him in any way. But he said that the internet will remain as insecure as it is possible to be and still function.
Mm.
And I think that's probably the case.
What is it they say? Good enough replaces best. Once again.
Yep.
Okay, Dan Gear, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
And thank you for having me.
That was Dan Gear there on the line from the USA. Up next, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Frederic Dennison of Microsoft. And we're talking to her about Forefront, Microsoft's corporate AV solution. Now, I've done a bit of independent work evaluating Forefront for a client using publicly available data and case studies and things like that. And contrary to what I expected, it's actually pretty decent. Its coverage is indeed what you would expect from a modern AV solution. The drawback has been so-so scalability and manageability, two things that the company plans to address in the release of its new version of Forefront, which is due out later this year. This new version will be configurable through System Center Configuration Manager, not Microsoft Operations Manager like the current version, and it'll basically be a much more large network-friendly bit of kit. And it's also pretty budget-friendly. Now, I'm not going to pretend for a second that I understand how Microsoft's client access licensing works, but I can tell you that it means Forefront is extremely cheap when compared to competing solutions for customers on CAL licenses. So when this latest version comes out, I suspect it could make a few waves in the enterprise market. So I got Frederic on the line to ask her if Microsoft is still tracking for a December release.
The latest communiques we've received from Corp are saying that we're on track for a release in December, December release, so before Christmas. The strategy we have to sell Forefront, so both on the client and then on the servers, is very much attached. It's about integration to the rest of the platform. So when we look at Forefront on the client, it's very much linked to our eCAL agreements. So pretty much all of our customers with eCAL have access to Forefront, and then it becomes a conversation around deployment rather than owning the licenses. And that then becomes a channel conversation. It's ensuring that we have the right partners that have the right access to the right level of readiness and that are migrating little by little our customers to the Forefront solution.
Could you do the listeners a favor and actually explain eCAL licensing?
Oh dear. That's essentially our client access licensing. It gives access to our customers to pretty much every client licenses for both Exchange, SharePoint. It gives them the entire suite of management licenses, as well as the Forefront security suite.
Okay, so it's pretty much an all-you-can-eat sort of license, isn't
it? Absolutely.
I guess the point I'm getting at, though, is that there's a major cost advantage to organizations that are on the eCAL licensing scheme to switch to Forefront. There seems to be a pretty clear budget driver there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
the point I'd like to make, not only it's certainly meant to be cost-effective, But the value proposition that we really try to drive, more importantly, is the level of integration we have on the platform.
So we were talking about the uptake, though. What has the uptake been like? Has it been in line with expectations? Has it been disappointing?
In terms of market share, we're still growing slowly, but it's a market that's completely penetrated. I think what's harder for us is to fully understand the level of deployment versus the level of licenses acquired. And I'm much more curious to, whenever I have a conversation with IDC, in my mind, it's not so much how many licenses do we have out there, but how many are deployed. Mm-hmm. In terms of share, we know we are growing faster than the market, and that's as demonstrated by the latest IDC, share dashboard.
And what's the current market share of Forefront?
So, we're still under 6%, but we're growing. We seem to be growing, nearly by 2 points faster than market.
And what's that measured on? Is that the number of desktop licenses, or?
So that would be identity and security revenue, the revenue share.
So I understand this next release of Forefront is a pretty important one for Microsoft, because the product has been re-engineered to be configurable through System Center Configuration Manager, which is a pretty big change. I understand there was some scalability limitations on the existing versions of Forefront that will be addressed in the next issue. Is that correct?
Initially, yes. I believe the FEP was initially built on Operations Manager, but we've moved it to Configuration Manager. That really addresses the unified AV and anti-spyware agents that we want to put on the desktop. So all the FEP 2010 is built on System Center Configuration Manager, which from our perspective really unified the solution for systems management and security. And that's a conversation we've been having for a number of years now. But the FEP release for us is really the the moment when we go to market with what we've promised.
Well, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Because there seems to be a pattern with Microsoft when it decides to take on a particular type of technology, whether it's web browsers or antivirus or whatever it is, which is the first generation is a go, a try. The second generation is functional, and the third generation is usually pretty good. I mean, do you think that's a fair assessment of how Forefront's technology has developed?
I think it absolutely is a fair assessment in that when we entered the market, we were new in a very, very mature market. And whilst we were leveraging, you know, an existing engine that was proven, there were certainly a lot of work in terms of integration and scalability we need to do and go through the motion. And I think the way Forefront and the Forefront brand and suite of products and the way it has evolved over the last 4 years is remarkable, and we've certainly reached a point where we feel quite comfortable. Comfortable as if we can ever be comfortable with security. But in terms of the way the anti-malware engine is now top rated by the AV comparative, in terms of the proactive detection we have with lowest false positive rates, and that certainly is, you know, a statement by third party.
Yeah, look, I think that, you know, the way I've understand is the engine's always been good. It's been the manageability that's been somewhat of a concern. But, you know, I understand too, the enterprise market has been actually waiting on this release, because many organisations on eCAL licences see it as being an excellent way to free up budget to spend on other things that might be perhaps, you know, a little more interesting than antivirus technology. So, you know, this is the release that people have been waiting for. It's the release that Microsoft has been working towards. And then, you know, a couple of months before you guys are due to release this stuff, along comes Intel and pays, you know, $7 billion or whatever it was for McAfee.
Yep.
And the talk suddenly becomes all about hardware-software integration in antivirus software and in endpoint security software. How dramatically does that acquisition change Microsoft's strategy when it comes to Forefront?
No, I think the same way we were just discussing, you know, the amount of time integration takes. So it's not necessarily just the software that's difficult to have, but it's the level of integration and the integration with management. And we see this acquisition exactly the same way. So I think from memory, they spent $7.6 billion, which is a huge acquisition from Intel. With this, they absolutely are going to address the mobile, the television, the ATMs, you know, connected devices in general. But by the time they develop the level of integration they need, I think we certainly have an opportunity to continue working with those guys the same way we've been, you know, somehow partnering for a number of years now to make sure that we continue protecting or making the best of the industry.
So it's really a case that you believe it will take a few years for those more advanced integrated products to actually get to market. So that's, you know, you've got a bit of time.
Right now, absolutely, and this is why, whilst we absolutely understand where they're going in terms of a strategic view, right now, I don't think it should be seen as a disruption. It's a move in the industry, but we're taking a slightly different strategy with our secure desktop solution and certainly the launch of Forefront Endpoint Protection 2010, and that's what we're going to focus on.
Do you think it's wise calling it Forefront Protection 2010 when it's nearly the end of 2010?
Naming conventions and Microsoft.
Yeah, I know. You guys have a habit of doing that, don't you? I'm sure as a marketing manager, you must want to send a few people internally some ticking mail.
Oh, don't worry, it happens.
Okay. Well, Frederik Denison, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on Microsoft's strategy around Forefront. I think it's going to be a very interesting product when it's out in earnest, when this latest version, configurable, sort of more scalable version, I think is probably going to give some of the incumbent players a bit of a hard time. So thank you very much for joining us for the update.
Thank you, Patrick. It was my pleasure.
Frederik Denison on the line from Microsoft there, bringing to a close this edition of the Risky Business Security Podcast. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening to the show.